Hello, this is your volunteer broadcaster, Cherise Stevens, bringing you today's Yuma Sun Daily with a look at life in and around Yuma. Let's get started with local news. Our first story is titled, Recorder's Office to Stay at Current Location by James Gilbert, Sun staff writer. The Yuma County Board of Supervisors voted Monday to allow Recorder David Lara and his staff to remain at their current location at 102 South Main Street rather than relocating to the new Yuma County Administration Services building later this year. Lara formally made the request after voicing concerns about the functionality of the new building, which is scheduled to open in December at 197 South Main Street. He said the building would not adequately support early voting operations or large-scale elections, such as presidential contest. The new building is a very nice building, but we all want to move to the new building, Lara told the board. But if it doesn't suit the voters and isn't efficient, we should remain where we're at. Lara said he and his staff had evaluated the YCAS site and found several issues, including limited space for early voting, inadequate parking, and complications in managing voter flow due to multiple entrances. I really listen to the staff and what they have been through and what they need, he said. It's not what they want, it's what they need. Lara also noted that significant renovations would be required if the recorder's office remains at its current location, including upgrades to meet both staff and voter needs. Supervisor Lynn Pancrazzi expressed concern about remodeling the property at 102 South Main Street, formerly known as the Hopstetter Building. She noted that the facility had already undergone renovations after the county purchased it in November of 2021. Could you operate in the building without it having to be renovated again the way it is now? She asked. I don't believe so. We need more space, Lara replied, referring to the need to remove some interior walls to meet operational requirements. Vice Chairman Jonathan Lyon said the board could direct staff to take the recommendation under advisement and noted that the recorder's office has $1 million available funding to support necessary renovations. Following the discussion, the board unanimously approved the request to keep the recorder's office at its current location. As a result, the Office of the Public Fiduciary, currently located at 3007 South Pacific Avenue, will now move into the YCAS building instead. Election Services, which also shares the 102 South Main Street location with the recorder's office, will still proceed with its planned move to the new facility. Next, we have Temp Trending Toward Peak, Moderate Heat Risk by Weekend by Alex Ibrahimi, Sun staff writer. In Yuma County, the weather trend this week is to remain hot and dry, with temperatures slowly climbing through the week. Starting on Monday, with a high of 103 degrees, temperatures were forecasted by the National Weather Service to approach 110 by Sunday into next Monday. Normal temperatures for this time of year are 107 for afternoon highs and 84 for overnight lows, NWS shared. So current forecast heat this week is actually slightly below normal, climbing to near normal by the weekend. We are in our normal peak of the heat season. While there are no current heat advisories or warnings this week, NWS Heat Risk, an experimental index, provided a forecast risk of heat-related impacts, predicts a climb from minor to moderate by this weekend. The moderate heat risk, NWS explained, is a level which affects most individuals sensitive to heat, especially those without effective cooling or effective hydration. Humans should practice a number of heat precautions to stay safe. Avoid being outside during max heating in the afternoon and early evenings, NWS warned. Plan outdoor activities early in the day when the temperatures are the lowest. If you must be outside, take numerous breaks inside from the heat and stay hydrated. Be sure to recognize the dangers of heat exhaustion and heat stroke. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the symptoms of heat exhaustion include dizziness, thirst, heavy sweating, nausea, and weakness. Those experiencing heat exhaustion should move to a cooler area, loosen clothing, and sip cool water. Medical help is necessary if symptoms don't improve. Heat exhaustion can lead to heat stroke, which can cause death or permanent disability if not treated immediately. Symptoms of heat stroke include confusion, dizziness, and losing consciousness. In this case, 911 should be called immediately. For more information on heat safety, visit www.weather.gov/safety/heat-illness. Next we have Water Main Break Prompts Lane Closure Temporary Outages by Jota Post, Sun Staff Writer. Yuma experienced a leak due to a water main break on Monday in the vicinity of 26th Street and 4th Avenue, affecting traffic and some water service. City crews responded to the scene, during which time a section of the 2600 block of South 4th Avenue was reduced to a single lane in both directions. The intersection of 26th Street and 4th Avenue also closed on the west side to allow construction equipment to make repairs. The outage affected some businesses, causing temporary water service outages, but the majority of their water was fully restored. However, the city noted the outage did not affect McDonald's or the Yuma Senior Living Retirement Community. No word on what caused the break in the water lines. Next up, Back to School Event by Jota Post, Yuma Sun. The Yuma Staples store held a back-to-school block party on Saturday morning. Families were greeted at the door by members of the Gorditas BMX Club, which showed visitors how to maintain their bicycles. Inside, people were treated to a variety of activities, including face painting and balloon animals. Several agencies were on hand, offering information regarding their programs. The event is held each year before the start of the new school year. Next up is back-to-school vaccinations to be offered at health fairs in San Luis, Pasasonayon, Bajo El Sol. To support families preparing for the start of the school year, the Comité de Bienestar and the Yuma County Health Department will host two health fairs focused primarily on child and youth vaccinations in San Luis. Liliana Arroyo, spokesperson for CDB, said the health fairs will take place on Thursday, July 24th and 31st, from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the Comité's Event Hall located at 963 East B Street. The purpose of the fairs is to ensure that children and youth are up to date with the vaccinations required by schools. We want to help parents keep their children's vaccination cards current, especially with the start of the school year, said Arroyo. The vaccinations offered during the fairs will include all those required for children from under 12 months of age to 18 years old. Each year, the organization hosts back-to-school vaccination events, and this year, there will be two dates on which these services will be provided at no cost to recipients, regardless of whether or not they have health insurance. Additionally, on each day of the fairs, 50 backpacks with school supplies will be given to students. Moreover, the health fairs will also offer vaccinations for adults over 18, including COVID-19 and tetanus shots. The CDB spokesperson added that families will also be able to access information about health resources, social services, immigration, employment, assistance for Mexican nationals in the area, and other resources. Organizations such as Campesinos Sin Fronteras and Sunset Health, the Department of Economic Security, and the Mexican Consulate in Yuma, among others, will have information tables to offer comprehensive support to attendees. Registration is not required to attend the fairs and take advantage of the vaccination services. For more information, call Comité de Bienestar at 928-627-8559. Our next story is titled, Ultra-Competitive YPG Employees Complete 250 Challenge in Marathon by Anna Henderson, Yuma Proving Ground. U.S. Army Yuma Proving Ground employees Ryan Ingham and Harley Hogan took the YPG Fitness Center's 250th Army Birthday Challenge to another level. The fitness challenge is one of many ways YPG commemorated the Army's 250th birthday on June 14, 2025. The YPG Fitness Center created the challenge, which involved repetitions of 250 squats, lunges, step-ups, push-ups, 250-meter swim and medicine ball carry, and a 2,500-meter row and 25 miles running, biking, walking challenges. While most of the 30 people who signed up for the challenge spent the time from June 1st to 14 to complete the challenge, the ultra-motivated and competitive athletes completed the challenge in one visit to the YPG Fitness Center. If I was going to do it, I was going to do it in one shot, just knock it out instead of 2 weeks, said Ingham, who came up with the idea. It took zero convincing to get his buddy on board. I enjoy challenges like that, so I was like, yeah, let's do it, recalled Hogan. The men who have both competed in ultra marathons did nothing special to physically prepare. However, they did take the day off work because while the Army's fitness program allows them time to work out during the workday, 1 hour was not enough. Ingham estimated that it would take them 6 to 8 hours to complete. So the two met up at 7 a.m. on June 3rd at the YPG Fitness Center and started the challenge with a plan. I thought the easiest would be to break it up into rounds, so 25 rounds with 10 reps of each of the workouts. When we needed a break, we could jump on a rower or the ball carry, explained Ingham. Even when they were headed to the restroom, they were efficient with their time. When we went to the bathroom, we carried the medicine ball across the room. Drop, go to the bathroom, grab it, take it back, recounted Ingham. As luck would have it, the AC was not functioning that day, but they did not let that slow them down. Hogan shared, the lunch workout crew came in there and then it got even hotter and there was no AC, so we stopped and went to the pool. The two didn't need to exchange motivational words or smack talk each other, Hogan said. I think motivation is just seeing someone else finish something and you're like, all right, I've got to keep going. Co-workers swung by to provide support and check their progress, and fitness facility manager Danny Compton documented their challenge with photos. When asked about the most challenging part of the marathon workout session, Hogan said, none of the workouts were any harder than the rest. They both agreed that stopping and going became a challenge. Ingham explained, toward the end, getting on and off the treadmill because you start to tighten up from the workout portion. It takes a little bit to start flowing again. And then once you start flowing, you don't want to stop. So towards the end, I started running 2 miles at a time, and then I would do my reps. They both finished the challenge in just over 6 hours and confirmed their knees, feet, and entire bodies did not hurt following the challenge. They headed right back to work the next day. Hogan said these types of challenges hosted by the YPG Fitness Program and the YPG Fitness Center add to employee morale. We love it. It's really made the workplace environment better and everyone is healthier and happier. So it's huge that we get to go and break the day up and go work out. Ingham and Hogan are gaining a reputation for setting the bar high. They recently both logged over 1 million steps in the recent YPG Step Challenge back in April and May. Some might ask, what's the next challenge? YPG Colonel John Nelson, motivated and inspired with the men's determination, approached Hogan about competing in a triathlon together in September. You are listening to the Yuma Sun Daily with Sharice Stevens on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Continuing local news, San Luis and Somerton approve budgets amid limited resources by Cesar Noyor Bajo El Sol. The two cities in the southern part of Yuma County have approved their budgets for the new fiscal year, which began on July 1st. However, both are once again facing financial limitations due to ongoing reductions in federal and state funding. On June 25, the San Luis City Council approved its 2025-2026 budget at $143 million, a figure higher than last year's budget of just over $122.3 million. The budget appears much larger, but in reality, revenues continue to decline, especially from sales, tax, and shared state and federal funds, said Mayor Neves Riddell in an interview. She explained that the apparent increase is due mainly to planned infrastructure projects for this fiscal year, particularly the expansion of the West wastewater treatment plant, which comes with a projected cost of $19.7 million. The issue with the treatment plant is something we've been dragging along for years. About 8 years ago, a temporary pipeline was installed to divert wastewater from the plant, west plant, to the east plant, but it became a habit and no effort was made to properly expand it, Riedel added. In Somerton, the 2026 fiscal year budget was approved on July 15 at $38.3 million, which is only about $2 million more than last year's. Mayor Gerardo Anaya explained that the budget reflects limited access to state and federal funding for projects they had hoped to advance, such as improvements to Main Street and city entrances, which remain unfunded. These projects are still included in the budget because we're going to keep trying to secure the necessary funds. Having them in the budget allows us to spend the funds if and when they become available, he clarified. He added that the city will have the resources to complete the replacement of asbestos pipes in the southern part of Somerton and install lighting at the sports fields in Perricone Park, among other projects. Regarding the possibility of further federal budget cuts, both mayors acknowledged it remains a concern. Anaya said there's not much left to cut, and the shared funding cities once relied on has steadily decreased. Riedel agreed cuts are more likely, but pointed out that another aspect of the federal government's approach, with greater emphasis on border security, more grant funding has been allocated to the police department, helping with projects such as replacing vehicles and outdated equipment. On our last story of local news, in the field, tractor and forklift safety training, Yuma County Cooperative Extension. Tractor overturns are the principal cause of fatalities on U.S. farms, resulting in around 200 deaths each year, with 1 in 10 operators overturning a tractor in their lifetime. Similarly, about 100 forklift-related deaths occur every year, with 8,000 injuries being serious enough to require days off from work. For these reasons, the University of Arizona Yuma County Cooperative Extension will be hosting a tractor and forklift safety workshop on August 5th and 6th at the Yuma Ag Center. This training, led by a private farm safety education company, offers a mix of classroom learning and hands-on demonstration with a focus on hazard recognition, equipment inspection, and safe operation techniques. Tailored to the needs of local agriculture and welcome to participants of all experience levels, attendees will receive 2 train-the-trainer certificates, 1 in tractor safety and 1 in forklift safety. Tuesday's session, August 5th, will be offered in Spanish, and Wednesday's, August 6th, in English. The Spanish session is almost at capacity with just a few spots left, and the English session is filling up quickly. Visit the Eventbrite page to save your spot to this free event. In state news, we have a look at the status of U.S. executions in 2025 by Adrian Sands, Associated Press. 26 men have died by court-ordered execution so far this year in the U.S., and 11 other people are scheduled to be put to death in 7 states during the remainder of 2025. Florida set its 10th execution of the year Friday when Republican Governor Ron DeSantis signed a death warrant for a man who abducted a woman from an insurance office and killed her 42 years ago. Kaylee Bates is scheduled to be executed on August 19. Florida also has the next scheduled execution on July 31st and was the last state to execute someone when Michael Bernard Bell died by lethal injection on July 15. Alabama, Indiana, Missouri, Tennessee, Texas, and Utah all have scheduled executions for later this year. Executions have been carried out this year in Alabama, Arizona, Florida, Indiana, Louisiana, Mississippi, Oklahoma, South Carolina, Tennessee, and Texas. The number of executions this year exceeds the 25 executions carried out last year and in 2018. It is the highest total since 2015, when 28 people were put to death. The uptick in executions can be traced to aggressive Republican governors and attorney generals pushing to get through lengthy appeals processes and get executions done, and John Bloom, the director of the Cornell Death Penalty Project. A sweeping executive order signed by President Donald Trump on his first day back in office aimed at urging prosecutors to seek the death penalty and preserving capital punishment in the states also may have fueled the increase, Bloom said. All but one execution this year has occurred in states run by Republican governors, with Arizona the exception. Here's a look at the recent executions and those scheduled for the rest of the year by state. Florida. Edward J. Zakarzewski is scheduled to be put to death in Florida on July 31st for killing his wife and two young children in 1994 after she sought a divorce. He eventually turned himself into law enforcement after the case was profiled on the television show Unsolved Mysteries. Bates, 67, who was scheduled to be executed August 19, was convicted of first-degree murder, kidnapping, and armed robbery, and attempted sexual battery on June 14, 1982, Bay County killing of Janet White. Tennessee. Byron Black, 69, is scheduled to die by lethal injection on August 5. Black was convicted in 1889 of three counts of first-degree murder for the shooting deaths of his girlfriend Angela Clay and her two daughters in Nashville. Black's lawyer asked a judge to require the Tennessee Department of Correction to deactivate an implanted defibrillation device similar to a pacemaker in moments before his execution. A Tennessee judge ruled Tuesday that the state can deactivate the heart-regulating device at a hospital on the morning of his execution rather than bringing a doctor or technician into the execution chamber. Black's motion related to his heart device came within a general challenge he and other death row inmates filed against the state's new execution protocol, which took effect this year. The trial isn't until 2026. Harold Nichols, 64, is also scheduled to die by lethal injection on December 11. Nichols was convicted of rape and first-degree felony murder in the 1988 death of Karen Pulley in Hamilton County. Alabama. David Lee Roberts, 59, is scheduled to be put to death by nitrogen gas on August 21st. Roberts was convicted of killing Anitra Jones in 1992 while he was a house guest at Jones' boyfriend's home in Marion County. Prosecutors said Roberts packed his belongings, stole money, and shot Jones three times in the head while she slept on the couch. Roberts set fire to the home to hide evidence. If carried out, he would be the nation's seventh execution by nitrogen gas, a method Alabama began using last year as an alternative to lethal injection. The method involves supplying nitrogen gas via a respirator mask to an inmate, causing the person to lose consciousness and die from lack of oxygen. Jeffrey T. West, 49, is scheduled to die by nitrogen gas on September 25th for the killing of convenience store clerk Margaret Parrish Berry during a 1997 robbery in Italia. Utah. Ralph Leroy Menzies, 67, is scheduled to die by firing squad on September 5. He would become the sixth U.S. prisoner executed by firing squad since 1977. Menzies, who has dementia, has been on death row for 37 years for abducting and killing mother of three, Maureen Hunsaker, 26, in 1986. Judge Matthew Bates signed a death warrant a month after he ruled Menzies consistently and rationally understands why he's facing execution despite recent cognitive decline. Attorneys for Menzies have petitioned the court for a reassessment. Texas. Blaine Milam, 35, is scheduled to die by lethal injection on September 25. Milam was convicted of killing his girlfriend's 13-month-old daughter during what the couple had said was a part of an exorcism in Rusk County in East Texas in December 2008. Milam's girlfriend, Jessica Carson, was also convicted of capital murder and sentenced to life in prison without parole. Robert Robertson is scheduled to be executed on October 16. Robertson, 58, could become the first person in the U.S. to be put to death for a murder conviction tied to shaken baby syndrome. He was convicted of the 2002 killing of his two-year-old daughter, Nikki Curtis, in the East Texas city of Palestine. Prosecutors argued he violently shook his daughter back and forth, causing severe head trauma. His lawyers and some medical experts say his daughter died not from abuse, but from complications related to pneumonia. Indiana. Indiana set a tentative execution date of October 10 for Roy Lee Ward, who was convicted of raping and killing a 15-year-old girl in 2001, but that date could change. Missouri. Lance C. Shockley is scheduled to be executed on October 14, according to the Nonprofit Death Penalty Information Center. Shockley was found guilty of first-degree murder in the death of Missouri State Highway Patrol Sergeant Dwayne Graham outside his home in Carner County in March of 2005. Testimony at the trial indicated Graham was killed because he was investigating Shockley for involuntary manslaughter and leaving the scene of an accident. Ohio. Earlier this year, Republican Governor Mike DeWine postponed five executions scheduled for 2025. All five have been delayed until 2028. If postponing the executions, DeWine has cited that the state's inability to secure drugs used in lethal injection due to pharmaceutical suppliers' unwillingness. DeWine said that he does not anticipate any further executions will happen during his term, which runs through 2026. The weather forecast for this week, starting with today, Wednesday, July 23rd, will have a low of 71 degrees, a high of 102 degrees, with an average humidity of 29% and 2 to 7 mile per hour winds. Thursday will have a low of 71, a high of 105, average humidity of 18%, and 3 to 8 mile per hour winds. Friday will see a low of 73 degrees, a high of 105, 13% average humidity, and 2 to 9 mile per hour winds. Saturday will have a low of 72 with a high of 105 degrees, 17% average humidity, and 2 to 6 mile per hour winds. All of this week, the UV index is in between 8 and 11, which is rated as very high to extreme by the World Health Organization, who has also recommended sun protection from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. daily. We are at the conclusion of today's Yuma Sun Daily program. This is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Cherie Stevens. Thank you for tuning in today. If you missed any part of this program, you can go to our website, sunsounds.org, and listen to it on demand under broadcast info and audio. The Wall Street Journal is next on Sun Sounds of Arizona.